and welcome to our quarterly Talking Property series, The House View. Together, CBRE's Australia and New Zealand CEO Phil Rowland and Head of Research Samir Chopra investigate what's next for the Australian property sector, the potential disruptors, emerging opportunities, and what's top of mind for the industry's major players. We hope you enjoy their conversation.
Hello, I'm Phil Rowland, and it is great to be back with CBRE's Head of Research, Samir Chopra, for our final edition of The House View for 2024. Housing continues to be a headline topic in the property sector as we try to chart a path towards greater supply, which ultimately will address a critical social outcome for the country. But of course, we can't overlook other social infrastructure that is equally important for the future of the country. So in this episode, we'll touch on the outlook for the healthcare, retirement living and childcare sectors, all very active sectors with their own unique dynamics. We'll also look at leasing activity and supply in the traditional sectors of office, industrial and retail, and the prevailing challenge of economic rents. And later in the podcast, we'll also cover some trends we're seeing in other parts of the world, along with some views on the key risks and opportunities in the property market as we move into 2025. So be sure to stick around for that. Samir, good to have you for our last edition for 2024.
Thanks, Phil.
I did want to start with global interest rates, though, and I've hit a few topics there in the introduction that we'll get to. But, you know, we're seeing some long-awaited easing of rates offshore, particularly with the Fed's announcement last month. So we're entering the fourth quarter of the year where there is now synchronized global interest rate cutting. We're seeing it in the US, parts of Europe, Canada, the UK, and, of course, New Zealand have all begun this phase. So as we anticipate the RBA's local response, it'd be good to get your views on what this means for Australia property and what we can learn from previous interest rate cycles. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Look, I think the question that'll increasingly get asked is, you know, how will capital markets react? Will we see deal activity pick up? And, you know, which sectors or real estate stock benefits from this? And just on that vein, you know, I caught a really interesting snippet from our US team. It came across in their cap rate survey. They do this quite frequently. And the latest cap rate survey suggests that US multifamily assets will be amongst the first and initial beneficiaries of cap rate compressions. And it'll come through first in gateway cities. So, you know, if you take that same thematic and apply it locally, perhaps we'll see initial cap rate compression in the highest quality assets. So in Australia, you know, that could be in CBD prime office, in super regional and regional shopping centers, and in super prime industrial in that inner ring area. And this will be one of the most important issues, you know, is just to figure out where might you see capital values regrow initially.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense to me. We've certainly seen the highest quality assets being more resilient on the leasing front. And some of the recent larger trades in the office sector would indicate a continuation of the flight to quality theme. An additional consideration is, of course, the debt market. You would assume that the cost of debt will become more favourable, you know, helping to make the investment case sort of stack up.
Yeah, and, but Phil, at the same time, you know, there's a contra-argument here, which is that this discount to book value is also closing as the REIT's share prices respond. And, you know, if you're a seller, maybe some of them will wonder if they should postpone their decisions by 6 to 12 months just to wait for a better market environment.
Well, there's certainly no shortage of capital that needs to be deployed. Estimates are that the Asia Pacific real estate funds are sitting on 60 to 70 billion of capital, which Australia will naturally be the beneficiary of. With investment volumes down 50% off peak levels over the last couple of years, there's clearly a lot of pent-up demand from investors looking for the right opportunities and returns.
Yeah, Phil, this concept of this dry powder, I just wonder if some of this dry powder now has some moisture in it. You know, real estate as an asset class, it's just underperformed other strategies like equities, particularly US equities. So I think, you know, as an industry, we need to kind of re-earn the trust of the pension funds and asset allocators. So my view is, you know, in the near term, maybe we'll get 0 to 10 bips of cap rate compression in the very best assets next year, and then a more meaningful sharpening in kind of 26 and 27. There is a case on the bull side, you know, there is a case for us to retest the levels that we saw in 22. I mean, if equities can trade on new peak valuation multiples, you know, why not real estate, especially if new supply remains very curtailed?
Yeah. Oh, well, this would imply that the RBA are going to start cutting rates in 24 some years. So what's your final pick for the year?
I'm still, Phil, predicting a cut at the end of the year.
Righto. Well, we'll see how that one lands. Okay, let's turn to social infrastructure, Samir. The demographic fundamentals for healthcare, retirement living and childcare are compelling. And again, we have this enormous supply side challenge. You and I both attended our healthcare and social infrastructure conference in Melbourne last month. Clearly no shortage of interest in this sector as investors look to build scale. My main takeaway from this event was the strength of the fundamentals as Australia's population grows and ages, but also what appears to be the resilience in the investment activity despite some of the regulatory and development challenges.
Phil, yeah, look, the demand side conditions are strong across all of the social and retirement living sector. If you look at childcare, for example, there is an extra 100,000 kids aged 0 to 5 in childcare that's been added over the last 8 years. This has kind of propelled demand in childcare. If you look at retirement living or even healthcare, in Australia, currently there's about 4.75 million people that's 65 and above. And this is projected to increase to nearly 7 million by 2040. So 4.75 million 65-year-olds growing to 7 million by 2040.
Yeah, really compelling statistics. Yeah, I found it really interesting hearing Sandro Peluso's view that while the sector's faced this regulatory uncertainty, particularly in healthcare, transaction activities remain pretty robust. And there was also a lot of discussion about a slowdown in the development pipeline. You know, while not solving the supply issue, it has helped to keep yields low in a rising interest rate environment. So I know you've done a deep dive on in each of these sectors, Samir. So let's look at the supply side for a moment, starting with, say, senior living. You know, what are the stats telling us?
Yeah, look, Phil, new supply of senior living stock has been growing at half of the pace of the increase in the target market. So the supply of aged care beds and retirement villages is growing at somewhere between 1 and 1.7% per annum, whereas the growth in that population, that target market, is about 2.4%. Just to kind of put it in perspective, Phil, you know, the sector, there's 430,000 places, that's beds and units, which makes up the senior housing sector. The sector is 4 times larger than student accommodation. It's 10 times larger than the current built-to-rent sector. These are, you know, it's quite a sizable sector.
Yeah, that relativity of scale is pretty stark, Samir. So what are your biggest takeaways for investors in senior living?
Look, one of the interesting things, Phil, here is just the low levels of institutional ownership. You know, for example, the market share of the top 5 operators in retirement villages is just 13%. In aged care units, just 17%. So, you know, my sense is that there's significant opportunities for consolidation over the next decade. The other point I'd make, Phil, is that product quality and amenity expectations continue to sort of evolve as new retirees. You know, they take advantage of bigger asset balances that they have. Older Australians tend to own their own homes outright. If you look at people that are kind of 75 years old, 83% of them now own their own home outright.
Mm. Yeah, and home values have increased markedly. The average home is now worth 960 grand.
Yeah, plus, you know, you add in superannuation. The typical kind of super balance for a couple that's 65 years old is around 750,000 on our calculations. So, you know, the asset values in aged care and retirement villages, they just haven't kept pace with this increase in that residential price growth. So in a relative sense, moving into these facilities today is a lot more attractive than it was recently.
So what about childcare, Samir? What are the supply-demand statistics telling us?
Yeah, incremental demand, you know, for places in childcare, incremental, runs at about 15,000 to 20,000 per annum. And approvals for new supply in the last 12 months, it's actually picked up. It's sitting at about 30,000. So this could be one of the few markets where we're actually getting some level of demand-supply balance.
Mm, that's good. Okay, so as we get more regulation clarity on fees in both aged care and childcare, it should help investors with their decision-making. So lastly, an adjacent sector is hospitals, and we've previously spoken about the significant investment that each of the state governments is making into public hospitals. I think with 36 large redevelopment projects and about 20 new builds planned or underway. So this creates enormous opportunities for real estate investors in healthcare precincts. So how do you see this taking shape?
I love healthcare precincts, Phil. They create massive opportunities for real estate owners across private hospitals, specialist hospitals, labs, medical offices, you know, essential worker accommodation and amenities. A fully comprehensive healthcare precinct is a $3 to $4 billion asset. And we see scope for, you know, at least 15 to 20 of these to be rolled out across Australia.
Yeah, no, it's significant. And it's really interesting, you know, when you zoom out and think about what Australia is doing in infrastructure, it's really strengthening its comparative advantage. You know, this investment into road, aviation, rail, defence, healthcare, you know, the Olympics, it's something that creates a really wide spectrum of investment opportunity. And of course, the government is planning for it. It needs to deliver it, obviously, and will continue to rely on development and capital partners to make it happen. All right, so let's change gears a little bit and look at what we're seeing in the traditional asset classes. And let's just focus, if we may, Samir, just on leasing inquiry and rental growth. So what's behind the softening of inquiry levels that we're seeing?
Yeah, Phil, look, I'd say that quantity of leasing inquiries is softer as we head into the fourth quarter and potentially into 2025. Two things are in play. A lot of leasing activity was front-end loaded. Like in 21 and 22, there was a lot of work done in industrial leasing, and in 22 and 23 in office. Some of this is just because, you know, there's a lot of new supply coming to market, and Australia is a high pre-leasing market, so there's a lot of pre-leasing activity. That's now just tapering off as supply gets constricted.
Mm. Yeah, look, there's no hiding behind the fact that we are seeing a slowing economy, and the softness in economic conditions means there is some hesitation beginning to creep in to undertake expansion or relocations.
Just on the fundamentals, Phil, I suppose the good news is that, you know, we haven't seen elevated sublease. This is something we keep a very close eye on. And, you know, in office and industrial, sublease has remained very manageable. So the picture's not for face rents to decline. In fact, we're seeing low single-digit annual face rent growth across most of the assets in the third quarter.
Mm. All right, but what about incentives? How are they moving?
Yeah, this is kind of where you're getting the bifurcation. Incentives have crept up further in kind of secondary locations, but they're holding and maybe even firming in the best locations. So maybe just to use an example, Phil, an extreme example, we're seeing incentives in the prime CBD core drop down towards the high 20s level. You know, they were at mid 30s, now they're high 20 levels. And that gives you about a 12% net effective rent growth, a very good outcome for landlords, similar to kind of what we've seen in Brisbane's Golden Triangle. Logistics as well, we're seeing, you know, in the outer markets, incentives are increasing slightly, say by a few percentage points. And that's largely driven by sort of pre-leasing activity. But they're quite firm, you know, in the inner ring markets where occupiers are just opting in for renewals.
Yeah. Well, let's just touch on supply for a minute. I know it's certainly topical in residential where we're now expecting apartment supply to hover around 50,000 a year over the next 5 years compared to a previous forecast of about 60,000 to 70,000. Of course, the issues around construction costs, cost of debt, you know, planning delays are not just restricted to the resi sector, right? So what are the stats in the other sectors telling us?
Yeah, look, Phil, we're pulling back across the deck. And part of this is just supply getting pushed back. A lot of it's kind of shelving of development. And just to give an example, you know, my colleague Sass Jalili shifted her supply numbers on logistics for 2024. They've been cut by 40% over the last 12 months. Shopping centers is another sector where, you know, we've been historically pulling back on supply. And right now, you know, I'd say it's 20 to 40% cancellation rates as projects continue to become unfeasible.
Well, that brings us to discuss economic rents and replacement value, Samir. So there's this sizable gap between current average value and replacement costs across almost every aspect of Australian real estate. In most cases, the gap is around 30 to 40%.
Yeah, look, Phil, this is probably one of the most important topics with clients as they do due diligence on acquisitions and developments. The replacement costs have moved out by 30 to 40%. So you need to achieve rents, which are now 30 to 40% above where they were sitting just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, all right. Well, so just walk us through the maths on where the economic rents are sitting. You know, maybe let's start off with office and then let's look at industrial.
Yeah, in office, Phil, we'd estimate that, you know, economic face rents for Sydney CBD for a new construction, new build, has increased by 42% from 2020 to now. So the last 5 years, gone up by 42%. And the drivers here, Phil, you know, there's been about 100 bips of cap rate expansion. You know, construction costs have jumped up by 32%. There's about 19% inflation in outgoings. You've got to bake in an extra 10% of higher incentives. So, you know, if you think about a current cap rate of 5.25% for a new build, you need to be achieving rents of $1,920 a square meter, whereas just 5 years ago, you know, $1,350 would have been good enough.
Mm-hmm. And for Melbourne and Brisbane, we estimate economic rents have increased by nearly 60% and 40% respectively since 2020.
Yeah, and it gets even tougher in logistics. We estimate that the economic face rents for Sydney, new build, has doubled over the last 5 years. And the driver here is, you know, it's that usual cap rate expansion, 100 to 150 basis points. But you've also got 60% increase in land value, you know, and then you've got this construction cost inflation. So, you know, we'd estimate that economic rents for Sydney industrial new development is somewhere around 250 to 270. Used to be 130 5 years ago.
Mm, yeah. And in residential, we've seen strong evidence of replacement costs, which are 30 to 40% above those 2020 levels, with the implication, of course, that new supply will continue to be directed at that premium end, you know, targeting locations and specific occupiers who can afford to pay the higher economic rents and values.
Yeah, and, you know, it also provides a tailwind for valuations in legacy assets. And, you know, to kind of put it crudely, you can't build it for the same price as the real estate that's already out there. And for most developments now, Phil, I'd say, you know, it needs a very comprehensive view of, you know, who is the target occupier segment, who is the target buyer out there. There are segments who pay these high rents, you know, or these high prices. It's just a matter of finding out, you know, who are they and how big is that cohort.
Mm. Well, higher economic rents and replacement costs are not just a local phenomenon, obviously. So let's just jump to see some international perspectives, Samir, and discuss what we're seeing in other markets. I've got a couple. The first one that caught my eye was when we recently caught up with Ada Choi, who now leads our Asia research team. It was really interesting to hear her talk about the big divergence that we're seeing in the Asian office markets. You look at India in particular, has seen really, really strong take up with occupiers with this big recent surge in offshoring activity. Obviously, you're not new to India, but we've seen this kind of recent wave. Yep. And then in stark contrast, you know, China's seeing this net absorption of about 40% below its five-year average. So a real kind of two-speed situation in Asia. The second one for me was our US data showing that office net absorption turned positive for the first time since 2019. So more than half of the markets we track in the US have reported positive net absorption, which is a very welcome and positive signal.
Yeah, Phil, and just going around the globe, in the London office sector, our data is also showing a clear preference for large floor plates. So larger floor plates, you know, those that are kind of over 20,000 square feet, they're leasing better than smaller floor plates, those that are kind of below 5,000 square feet. And leasing in these larger floor plates, you know, is up 5% on historical levels, and on the smaller floor plates is down 18% on historical levels.
Yeah, and I see evidence corporate occupiers just really want best quality space in the most central locations, and within each sort of individual submarket, and they would really want to fulfil those requirements across as few floors as possible.
Yeah, Phil, and look, just sticking with London, you know, I found this survey that we recently conducted of in the residential market there fascinating, probably one of the best surveys I've come across. The number one factor when it comes to choosing where people want to move to in terms of their housing is safety. And, you know, safety rated ahead of housing affordability and proximity to public transport.
Mm, interesting. Okay, Samir, let's round it off now with some calls on the risks and opportunities as we look into 2025. So you want to go first?
Yeah, Phil, let me go first with what I see probably as a risk that worries me the most. I worry about the scope for property taxes to increase again. You know, we've just been through a period where land tax and stamp duty, foreign stamp duty, have increased. But for me, you know, the biggest risk is that these could continue to sort of inflate and escalate further in the next few years, you know, state governments and councils try to balance their budgets.
Yeah, clearly. Well, I think those risks are very real, Samir. For me, and somewhat related to your point, is I think costs and margins will continue to be a real risk going forward. You know, while we're seeing inflation ease, I remain really cautious on the cost of doing business. There are still plenty of cost items that remain elevated, you know, whether you think about utilities or wages, for example. And there's been a number of regulatory changes that have very real time and cost impacts. So all of these have increased for both occupiers and landlords, and something for us to continue to be vigilant on. Okay, Samir, so I know you're a glass half full guy. So what about your top picks on opportunities?
Yep, Phil, glass half full, or maybe even more. On the bullish side, the replacement cost argument is very compelling, I think, in real estate, particularly in sectors with supply constraints. You know, so my favorite three sectors right now are regional shopping centers, residential built to sell, and student accommodation. You know, I know as parents, we're not allowed to have favorite children, but I like these ones more.
All right. Well, I know I bet against you earlier in the year on the timing of rate cuts in Australia, Samir, but I do think that the wind is shifting a little on that. I'm not giving up on my bet against you. So if we do see the RBA start the easing process this year, it does bode well for investment activity to recover next year. So particularly for those assets which can't be replicated easily. So I think that wraps us up. Thank you, Samir, and thank you to our listeners. I hope you enjoyed this latest edition of The House View. You can send us your feedback and any questions you might have via talkingproperty@cbre.com. We'll be back with The House View next year, so make sure to subscribe to Talking Property so you don't miss out on our kickoff episode for 2025. In the meantime, you can tune in to CBRE's fortnightly Talking Property episodes. Until next time.
Beautiful.